Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
You're listening to Down to Agribusiness with the Irish Farmers Journal.
Hi, folks. Welcome to this week's Down to Agribusiness podcast. I'm joined once again by Anne Finnegan and Phelim O'Neill to have a chat about the week's stories in agribusiness. Phelim, I might start with you. I'm just in from one of those CAP meetings that there's a tour nationwide by the Department of Officials, I suppose, explaining the new CAP. And I was at the one in South Tipperary on the Waterford border. And look at Phelim, I mean, it's fair to say it turned into a rant against, I suppose, the new CAP in terms of what it's trying to do. I mean, the team of department officials stood up and each went through their various schemes, from the Suckler scheme to all the various schemes, the new environmental schemes, etc. And in a very professional way and very clear. Now, there was huge information. There was over 60 slides of information in an hour. So there was, like, farmers were bombarded with information. But I mean, farmer after farmer stood up after the presentations and said, listen, we're in a new world order here. Food production is priority. Here you are putting viable, productive farmers out of business. That's their words. I think you need to reconsider this, you know. So farmer after farmer stood up, you know, in that vein that against the new CAP and what it was, the aim of it was. Do you think there's going to be any move that at EU level? I mean, just to finish off my piece, the department officials said, listen, guys, we have nothing signed and sealed on this CAP yet. And there could well be changes from the EU Commission. They were at pains to stress that, you know, but here they are explaining a scheme in a different world. Just talk to me, Phelim, about kind of when that CAP was kind of created and the kind of thinking that was on the ground then and where we are now.
Interesting to hear that, Jack. And yes, the CAP was conceived back in 2018. I think, as you say, a totally different world, pre-pandemic, pre-war in Ukraine, etc. And, you know, the backdrop then was very much about how we could reduce the emissions from Europe, how we could devise a more environment-friendly farming, more welfare-friendly farming. It was essentially food production was secondary to land maintenance, was the basic ethos of it, or that's certainly how it felt. Of course, the world has changed completely since then. And, you know, I'm just intrigued there, the last comment you made, Jack, about the nothing signed and sealed yet. And I thought it was striking. Last week, there were a couple of fairly major meetings that were, if you like, because of the war in Ukraine and what it's likely to do to food production. But the one that's of particular relevance to the CAP, I thought, was gathering of the heads of state, the EU heads of state, as a council meeting in Versailles. France holds the presidency of the EU Council at the moment. So they hosted a special meeting. And at it, I thought it was interesting to see in the communique at the end of it that they had instructed the Commission to go away and come up with proposals on food security. security and production. Now, I thought that was strikingly frank, if you like, in terms of political leadership and political direction. If we went back to the week before, I recall that the Commission itself came out with suggestion that perhaps they would look at bringing the 10%, the set-aside land, if you like, back into play to reflect the circumstances that we're in at the minute. But I think there was a realisation maybe at last week's gathering of the need here for Europe to push on with production. And that was reinforced then by the meeting of the G7 agriculture ministers. It was held virtually on the same day, in fact. And they received a briefing from the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations, FAO. And it put in pretty stark, blunt terms of what this was going to mean for world food production, grain that's available for trade and the knock-on effect for world hunger. So I think it's fair to say it's a very different place now, Jack, from when the CAP was originally conceived back in 2018.
And do you conceivably think, Phelan, that there could be relatively big changes to the CAP? I mean, here we are, and there's a nationwide tour of explaining to farmers. It's a big deal now. You know, I mean, there's a lot of paperwork behind this piece. There's a lot of other people involved in the space, from planners to advisors to, you know, I mean, you conceivably think that there could be changes to the CAP. That now, of course, it's not starting in 2022. This is a 2023 project, you know. So, I mean, there is time, like.
Very much so. And you know, it has been rolled over for the past 2 years. So if you can roll it over 1 year or 2 years, you can roll it over 3 years while you devise something else. Look, the compelling case, I feel, for taking a serious look at this, a fresh look at it, is to be found in what the FAO submitted to the G7 agriculture ministers. And we're covering this in detail. Actually, we're just touching on it in the print edition of the paper this week, Jack, but we're going into it in some more depth online. But, you know, the headline figures from that are, like, they're expecting this year that 20% of the winter crops harvest is likely to be lost in Ukraine. And they're also saying this is their best estimate with the information they have now. Could be worse than that. Probably unlikely to be better than, given what's happened up to date. They also see a loss in yield of those that are there. The spring planting, they think it'll be down by at least a third, and it could be worse. 20% less yield. And the knock-on effect of that is they see that the number of people that will be exposed to hunger in the poorer countries of the world will be between 7.6 and 13 million for more people. You know, that's the consequence of it. And so as against that background, we need to think then about, in the fertile lands of Europe, what can we do to contribute more food, not less? And we can't turn our back on the issue of emissions and global warming, etc. But we have to try and do both now. It's not a case of choosing one over the other.
And you're on one of those ingredients, and you're looking at it through an Irish lens, I suppose, in terms of producing feed in an Irish context, and that's the fertilizer game. You've a really nice piece. Just looking behind, I suppose, the numbers in terms of fertilizer volumes and prices that are coming into the country, I suppose, which is high on the agenda for a lot of farmers this week in terms of action in the fields, but also trying to secure fertilizer in the light of suspensions of trade in an Irish context from co-ops, etc., and that kind of thing. Talk to me about your piece.
Yeah, Jack. So what I've looked at this week is the CSO, the Central Statistics Office data on fertilizer imports into the country between July and December in 2021. And that's the most recently available and, I suppose, the most relevant data that's available to us. So at an overall level, fertilizer imports in the last 6 months of 2021 were more or less aligned with the previous year. They were down 6%. Urea imports were up 4% for the period from July to December. And the average import price of a tonne of urea into the country in that time was €643 a tonne. Now, almost, I suppose, I focused mainly in the analysis on the October to December period, because the fertiliser that comes in that period is generally used as stock building for spring, whereas what comes in the first 3 months of the second half is generally consumed by farmers. So in the last 3 months, October to December, the average price was €643 a tonne, and almost 60% of what was imported in those 3 months came in November at an average price of €650 a tonne. Similarly, can volumes were down 8% year on year. The average import price in the 3 months from October to December was €380 a tonne. the CAN was kind of more spread out than the urea purchases or landings, let's say, in those 3 months. 35% came in November at an average price of $3.79 a ton, 31% in December at $4.81 a ton, and a third almost was in October at $2.90 a ton. So, I mean, I think what the data is showing us, and there's a lot of figures in this, and we've left it like that so people can look through it and mull over it themselves. But I suppose what it is showing us is, I suppose in the 3 months from July to September, I think importers probably stepped out of the market a little bit, particularly for urea. They bought a lot less than they had done the previous year. And that makes sense in terms of where the market was going. They were in a rising market. And I would imagine waiting to see if that was going to turn. And that was more than made up for in terms of urea in the second 3 months. But also it shows that, you know, the fertilizer was well spread out, the purchases, and it wasn't all bought at those high prices in December and those pretty scary prices that we remember. I mean, we were talking about a peak of about $935 a ton in mid-November, which is about 830 euros a ton. So very little urea was bought at that price in the overall scheme. I think about 20% landed in December at a value of 830 euros a ton. So I suppose it gives a sense of what came into the country and what price that was at when it landed.
And Anne, compared to the year previous, like, I mean, what was the difference in euros per ton at the dock, we'll say, at the import price level, you know, compared to the year previous? What was it up? Was it up 200 or 300 euros a ton, or how much was it up?
Yeah, it was up significantly. So urea was up almost 400 euros a ton on average for the October to December period. So substantially up. I mean, we also did a little bit of analysis looking at, you know, what farmers have paid and versus the average import price for those 3 months, October to December. In the case of urea, we know from, I suppose, talking to farmers, but also from industry issued retail price lists, that farmers have been paying 900 euros a ton for urea. And that's about 257 euros a ton above the average import price. So, I mean, if all stock traded at that average price, or at 900 euros a ton of all of the stock that came in, it would amount to a surplus of about 18 million from which supply chain costs and margins are covered. And I should say that the import price that's recorded by the CSO is really just the value that the importer has paid for the fertilizer. So it excludes all of the supply chain costs, the margin, the transport, packaging, palletizing, all of those costs, which in fairness have all increased in the past 12 months. So you're talking about a surplus of 18.2 million. And if you compare that to the year previously, looking at, you know, farmers paying on average 400 euros a ton for urea, and that was about 148 euros a ton over the average import price, there's a significant difference in the surplus. The surplus in the previous year would have amounted to about 7.4 million. So there's a serious differential in terms of what importers paid for prices, but it's also translated into much higher prices for farmers this year.
And Anne, is there a piece around that it looks like that the kind of importers were building in a kind of a little bit of a value on political risk, or I suppose risk that they didn't know what was going to happen, some product, or, you know, in terms of, you know, it's not a tangible risk, but that they were building in something for kind of maybe even a credit risk, I suppose, associated with a huge price relative to where it was.
Yeah, I would imagine so. I mean, in a market like they were faced with, I think reasonably they would have factored in, let's say, additional risk into the market price. And the risk would have been that in a high and a volatile market, like what they had been trading in up to Christmas, the risk is always that at the back end and at the end of the season, prices start to fall internationally and they're left with stock that they bought at high prices. And I suppose recouping that price is then very difficult in the market. So yes, they typically would factor in an amount of risk in that type of market to see them through the back end. I suppose what's changed now is that the prospect of that market downturn is now gone. I would say as a result of the war in Ukraine and Russia being largely locked out of the market. So it appears that the market has changed substantially.
Yeah, no, look, I think very interesting. And for anyone that wants to get a feel for that, there's great numbers and analysis in the journal this week.
The Irish Farmers Journal has now reached our highest ever readership with 321,000 weekly print readers. Thank you for your support.
Bela, maybe just to finish with you, Bord Bia at the CAP meeting last night got an airing. Obviously, Tara McCarthy has stepped down from her position since we were last talking. But you also were kind of looking at a piece that Joe Burke had a letter to the editor last week. I suppose he was trying to explain the kind of the background to the quality assurance schemes and why they were the quality assurance schemes, what they led to. I mean, you had a chat with Joe again this week just to kind of flesh that out another little bit.
That's right, Jack. I picked that up, that letter from Joe, and I thought that it was worth teasing out a bit more. And in the conversation that I had with Joe this week, and it's reported on full in the paper, the problem, I suppose, here, farmers have been producing and heard so much about specifications in recent years. And we've looked at a situation developed now over recent months where the market has moved on. It has moved on for Irish farmers in terms of beef price too, but it has moved on even more in continental Europe. And we're left sitting looking at a picture, I suppose, where the Irish price, it certainly isn't leading, it's following what's happening elsewhere in Europe. So I thought I would pick this up with Joe, and he did, in fairness, he recognised that the price has pushed on faster in Europe. And the reality is that I suppose Irish beef has been traditionally moved into the UK retail and the major burger chain outlets. That has been the core customer base for it. And it's difficult and doesn't happen overnight that the processors that are supplying those outlets walk away from them to maybe switch to higher value markets in continental Europe. Now, he would say that he would expect this year that we will see a movement in that direction, but it's not the sudden jerk. And you will find that in terms of a price alignment, that countries, for example, like Poland, like the Netherlands, who would traditionally lag behind the Irish beef price, they're much more flexible and manoeuvrable in that respect. They have less long-term commitments and they are able to switch, if you like, overnight to play the market, to get the spot market. There's a couple of other things that stood out for me as well in that. And one thing he pointed out is we shouldn't underestimate the cost of transport and haulage in the context of Irish beef sales in further flung markets. Because if you think back to it, with Brexit arriving last year, we have a big switch from using the land bridge through Britain to continental markets. Now we go the long way around on the direct ferries to avoid the Brexit bureaucracy. That has added cost, it has added time. And also you have the whole wider issue of shipping costs. And as it points out, you know, it's a lot easier. The German market is the one for manufacturing beef that's particularly hot at the moment. And it's a lot cheaper to get product from Poland, which is next door to Germany, if you like, on the continent, than it is from Ireland, that there's greater cost there. So look, it's something that we'll be revisiting again. It's something certainly that we'll be monitoring, Jack, because the reality is, whilst we have had a welcome rise in Irish beef prices over the last 12 months, the reality is that they've risen faster elsewhere. And I suppose farmers then correctly ask the question, you know, look, we do we go the extra mile, if you like, in terms of how we farm and run our business and participate in all of the schemes. And, you know, they ask the question, where's the value for that? And that's what we teased out with Joe this week.
Yeah, no, interesting. As you say, we're all talking about rising prices and meeting stricter conditions. One of the pieces that I did this week was on the FVD, and it's probably one area where costs are actually coming down. I suppose it is on the background of COVID piece and less happening in terms of transport, etc., and that kind of thing. So there wasn't as much activity. So premiums are down. The FVD results show that. I suppose it is one that definitely will evolve. There's obviously a lot more competition in the market as well. That's another reason why insurance premiums are coming down. But look, definitely FVD are back making money. They went from a loss-making year in 2020 to making close to 100 million this year.
Well, they had the exceptional situation, of course, with the pub insurance and the pandemic question. They got out of that better than they thought.
Correct. Jack, so. I'd say so. Absolutely. Yeah, they did. And it, okay, it's not finally done and dusted, but it's very close to it. They're still in discussions. But no, I think they can see the light now, and they can see the end of that piece of work, which is not going to cause them severe difficulty, I suppose, in terms of payouts. And they have obviously reinsured a lot of that risk as well. So yeah, no, look, they're in a better place than they were this time last year, and Thomas O'Midyok, the CEO, is definitely a happier person, I'd say, in terms of where he can see at the moment in terms of the light. So yeah, no, looking for anyone that's interested in that, there's a piece on that as well in the journal and online at farmersjournal.ie. folks, listen, it's been good. I'll let you back to the horses, and we can catch up again next week.
We hope you enjoyed this Irish Farmers Journal podcast. You can find all our podcasts at farmersjournal.ie/podcast and on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.